Well, good evening, Horace. I have to admit, all of this autonomous car talk has me feeling a bit ostalgie. That is a German term of nostalgia for aspects of life in East Germany. I was in a Berlin cab a few months ago, and we hopped in to escape a soccer fan crush. These fans were from Dortmund and Wolfsburg. Well, anyway, the driver entertained us for the whole journey with tales of these two cities, and then she continued by expressing disgust with what has become of Berlin. These young people, they don't care about an apartment, she said. They just arrive and they'll be happy to party and sleep on the couch day after day. Which brings us back to a SIM car. And I'm wondering, you know, is housing the autonomous car's job to be done? Will those future Berlin immigrants simply crash in their pod cars?
Right. So this is a good question, because if we look at some of the design concepts that we've seen come up
Mercedes
lately.
Right.
Most people, if you give a designer the job, here's design an autonomous car, they come up with a living room.
Exactly.
And I don't blame them. That's exactly what I would design as a space. I'm reminded also of a great Top Gear show or episode they did where Clarkson was asked. Or he asked the sort of rhetorical question, what would we do about making the design of cars more comfortable? And his answer was, make it more like my living room, because I think of my living room as the most comfortable place in the world. And so they went about transforming an S-Class into a country cottage.
Right.
And it was a terrible idea, but it was comical, but it was actually, there's a grain of truth to it, because if the car drives itself, why does we have to orient ourselves around the driving position? And so we haven't actually spent a lot of time on this show talking about autonomous cars. In fact, when I first started, I had a comment come in. You said you guys went on and on about the future of the car, and you never mentioned autonomy. because we didn't have a good reason then, but we do have a good reason now, which is because if you talk about autonomous vehicles, they're no longer cars. And here's what I mean. I think they're going to be autonomous Winnebagos. And the reason it makes sense to put a driver...
It's a rather ugly visual, you know.
Well, I don't, you know, I
mean, they are what they are, big rectangles, yeah.
But I don't want to say autonomous RV, it's an autonomous Winnebago, because what it is ultimately a house, and therefore for it to get better, it'll just become a better house. It will not become a better car. And so, meaning that it won't be about going fast anymore or taking turns at speed or whatever it is that you define as performance now. The thing is this, here's how the logic flows. Firstly is the designer's question, okay, you don't need to drive anymore, so you orient around the space and you just get better. But let's think about it as a job to be done. What you might do immediately as you got your own car, an autonomous car, is that you wouldn't think so much about the time before you get in the car being separate from the time when you're in the car, meaning you're going to blend these two times together. So instead of finishing your cup of coffee, you're going to take it with you. People already do that, right? They take their coffee with them in their car, so that's why we could develop cup holders. It's the best technology ever invented for cars.
And the Germans held out, I think, as long as anybody on that. But anyway, yes.
Well,
yes.
to their, you know, they live to regret that because now they lost market share because of this. Second thing is that people start to do things in their car because they're stuck in traffic, which should not be done in a car, like putting on their makeup, reading, texting, having calls, doing email, shaving, you know, not being sexist, you know, who knows, shaving whatever body part you want. But the thing is that people have moved the domestic activity
into the car, even
office activity into the car. So already there's a demand for doing that. So if you took away the steering wheel, you would naturally move more of it in, and you would say, I want to blend my office life into my car life, and I want to blend my house, my home life into my car life. And that means that the car will evolve into the space that lets you do that. So that means you're going to have an office as a car, and you're going to have a home as a car. And that means more things get done. So you'll say to yourself, well, I could, for example, take longer. I don't mind having a two-hour commute I'm just I'm going to get in my car early in my pajamas. I'm going to have my wardrobe with me. And, you know, I'll keep a couple of shirts in my car. Maybe have sufficient water to get cleaned up and shave. And so it becomes the space which I occupy between sleep and work. Literally, like, you know, I'll get out of bed, get in my car, and it takes me to work. And if I don't get there in time, I'll pop open my laptop and get started anyway at 9 o'clock, whatever the traffic is. So of course, if that's the new job to be done, then people are going to develop the around that job. They're going to start, and you know, you'll segment around that job. So it'll be, instead of buying you know, an SUV, crossover, whatever they're called these days, you'll be buying a living room, or you'll be buying an office, or you'll be buying a shower. And so, you know, you'll see segmentation of vehicle by essentially the room in your life. Like, and then, of course, luxury will be having all of those things. So you'll have a living room, a bedroom, you know, an office, and a shower. And what is that? It's a Winnebago. Hence, that is the future of driverless cars. Now, here's the next step in this logic. If it's a Winnebago, then why do you need a house anymore? Because it could be a great house. It'll be the size of a bus. Let's make it, you know, a luxury bus. That's still cheaper, even if it's hundreds of thousands. That's still cheaper than a really, really, really bad apartment in San Francisco. So, which no one on the East Coast would ever agree to live in, by the way, because they're really bad. So you start thinking about creating vehicles that substitute houses, or at least apartments in the beginning. And there are plenty of people today who are retired who have already achieved that high degree of wisdom. Secondly, there are people who are young who are abandoning, you know, the fixed house prop idea and living in cars again.
Sure.
And, you know, I hear about people in Google doing that.
Right, living in an old truck. Yeah, exactly.
Big trucks, box truck, yeah. You know, minivans, station wagons. The roomier the thing is, the better it is for this job. So forget about the ultimate driving machine. It'll be the ultimate sleeping
comfort machine, right?
Yeah, the ultimate apartment. So you're going to have parties there. You're going to invite your friends over. And the vehicle will just cruise randomly while it's doing this. Because
we have been here before, Horace, right? I mean, in the 60s and 70s in the States anyway, there were vans and van conversions. And, of course, Volkswagen had a massive business with their vans. And then that kind of petered out. I've always wondered about that. You know, there was all this customization and putting couches in vans and all these things.
Sure,
and
the 70s. You know, if the vans are rocking, don't come knocking.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So
why did that die? I mean, people got tired of driving.
Because people grew up and got houses. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that this inversion of that trend is because the house will – the luxury, the new definition of luxury will be the house on wheels because it'll be autonomous. See, here's the thing. So you start to think of what the consequences are for society. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. 2% of our space is taken up by roads anyway. So why not? And that space is public space and you're allowed on it as long as you're driving. And presumably if the laws go by and say, well, you're allowed to have a machine that's doing the driving, then why not why not occupy that space for free? Hey, you know, your taxpayer is paying for the road construction and just plant this autonomous Winnebago that just constantly runs. If it consumes gas and hopefully gas will consume electricity, then you'll just have this perpetual motion machine literally constantly feeding itself off the grid, driving randomly, even when you're not in it. By the way, I suppose you're not going to be able to park it because that will be forbidden. That will be illegal because otherwise we would have the Walmart parking lot with, you know, literally 10,000 Winnebagos on it. as the permanent residents of 10,000
transient population, right? Right.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm not judging them. They could be very, very reasonable people that do this, and so college students, you know, single people, young families, they'll all have their autonomous vehicle that will be their home, and as a result, the regulations will change, and you'll have signs in every parking lot saying no autonomous Winnebagos allowed, and then they'll be essentially kicked off the private land, and they'll be, as a result, roaming public land, which we call roads. Now, you might say, well, what's the use of a car that's constantly moving? Well, you'll just take your Uber to and from it whenever you wanted to leave it, and you'll just sort of catch up with it at some point. Oh, it may come to you, but I suspect it won't, because it'll be stuck in the traffic jam, because all the roads will be filled with autonomous Winnebagos.
People living,
and that's the future. The future of autonomy. The future of autonomy is all
is
roads
housing.
permanently occupied with vehicles stuck in traffic, which are essentially people's homes. It is an inevitable consequence of autonomy, and I don't know why nobody else has come to the same conclusion.
So, from today in 2015, the end of 2015 to that point for our kids, maybe, or maybe us later in
life. And you don't need to have your Tesla or your Google will sell you a little laptop that you'll plug into an existing Winnebago, and it'll turn into an autonomous Winnebago, as you can imagine, because that would be the business model for Google, right? I mean, you just do Winnebago conversions or RV conversions or bus conversions. So people will just take buses, gut them, fill them with living rooms and showers, then plug in a laptop and whatever servos are necessary to operate it, and you're done. I mean, that makes sense, right? Cheaper than a house.
Cheaper than it, definitely. You know, we do have things like that, though, in the States in different locations, and they're called mobile home parks. Now, they're not continuously moving, but they're typically not all that well received culturally. They're often, you know, people try to redevelop them, and there's controversy over that. So,
but that's the reason is that they're in locations that are distant from where other people, you know, where people want to be. So you don't want to zone an area for an RV park in an urban environment. What autonomy does is it puts that vehicle on the road.
On the road, right.
Constantly moving.
Yes.
Therefore not taking, you know, not accumulating parking tickets. And if it happens to block an intersection, well, eventually it'll move, right? I mean, what are you going to do? Give it a moving violation? Perhaps, maybe. I don't know. But does this not sound to you like the actual only possible outcome of autonomy? I just take it all to its logical conclusion. The idea that pure autonomy is about making my commute a little bit less painful.
It won't stop there, no doubt about that. I agree with you.
It just seems a very, very minor win for such a powerful technology. The true disruption of autonomous vehicles is to housing, and it'll be through and by the way, always vehicles have affected housing. The fact that we got cars allowed us to have suburbs. If we didn't have cars, we wouldn't have suburbs.
We wouldn't have
malls. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have malls. We wouldn't have the Amazon. We wouldn't have any of that. We would still be living in apartment blocks, much like North Korea does, or former Soviet Union did.
Right. East Berlin, 1965, yeah.
Right, and there's something, you know, I don't say it's all bad, but if you have a purely urban environment, you don't need a car, and hence, you know, we might split into this kind of like roaming Winnebagos in you know, driving around deserted suburbs. Sort of like suburbs, because nobody wants to live in a house
anymore, right?
And you know, it'd be like Detroit everywhere, and in, you know, urban areas where no cars are allowed, because that's the other trend that's happening.
So yes, it is.
You know, urban areas are going to ban cars, and those who can't afford in what will become multi-million-dollar, you know, holes in the wall.
Exactly, the price,
which because you know that's what you're going to end up with there. And because when you, as soon as you take away the car, it's like you're locking the opportunity to move very, very easily. Anyway, I don't want to go too far down that road, but let's assume that it goes into this like cars have and have nots, and that those who have cars are essentially going to convert them into houses.
Into houses, right. And we, as you said, we do see some of that in the Bay Area where people are living in their cars or trucks, or it's already happened.
And but if you were to suggest that maybe perhaps I'm reducing this to an absurdity, you might also be right, because actually I suspect that autonomy is a further out than I think most people think it is, not because it can't be done technically, but because the laws and the systems that it needs to plug into are actually going to resist it far longer. And it is not just because people are being idiots. It's because actually it doesn't fit. It does not fit into the infrastructures we have.
The norms of today, right.
And it's the roads and everything else. But because if you start to, again, think through some of these scenarios, some of these utopias about driverless cars, let's take one, for example. One of my favorites is the notion that, well, if we had these pods driving around and essentially being autonomous Ubers, we won't need to own cars and we'll just, we'll reduce the amount of cars on the road. But what about rush hour? What if everybody needs to go exactly at the same time home?
Sure.
Doesn't that mean you need exactly the same number of cars as you do today?
With the same problems, right? Of course.
Right. And so you'd have to somehow assume that there's an absolutely even distribution of demand. When it isn't, demand is very, very non-linear or non-uniform. And so there's always going to be a surge. And what do you do with the vehicles then? They're parked during the day and then they suddenly have to rush off to find. And so I don't see how that plays out on a larger scale. But then again, maybe I'm just a little bit fashion.
The nature of work and the place of work certainly continues to change. I mean, you're an example of that. And many people work remotely or work on the go. And so that to me would lend itself to some level, and we talked to David Levinson a while, the transportationist, about this topic and what happened to all the traffic. And so that may be
But I think a lot of traffic decline has been because people have slowed down their socializing and their shopping on using vehicles. But I think work hasn't yet caught up with that. I rack up 100,000 miles a year. On an aircraft, however,
yes,
and whereas my driving miles are really low,
yes,
and so I do take public transportation. It happens to be a plane.
So let's talk about those cultural changes, or let's say political or legal changes. There was an article, I think, out of Tokyo from the motor show recently that Toyota's new AI guy, who came from DARPA, said that the highway mode, the autonomous highway mode, is very close. And, so can you imagine this starts, maybe as you said, with certain roads or certain high-speed interstates, high-speed autobahns, and there you can cruise autonomously, and then we have this other system, as you say.
It's got to be careful, because autonomous means specifically the vehicle can entirely by itself.
Entirely, yeah.
I think assisted driving, where the assistance is increasing, so we've had assistance in driving for a long time. We've had power brakes.
Sure.
We've had power steering. Cruise control. We've had ignition that you turn a key for. Because before any of that stuff, driving meant being a mechanic. Driving meant hand cranking a car. Driving meant knowing how to fix everything on it every day, because it would break. So we've had all of these things become easier. So in many ways, and this is why when you evaluate autonomy, people put Mercedes as number one, or Daimler as a company number one, because they've actually done the most to actually ship product that is assisting the driver more and more. And so they've had almost like 15 years ago, they were selling cars with intelligent cruise control. So,
doesn't that begin to create a regulatory or legal regime that opens the door for the things you're talking about, right? So certain roads.
The tendency. So here's my point: is that there is there's an opposite viewpoint, which is Google, which says that there can be only two things, the way it is now and fully autonomous cars, because anything that gets close to full autonomy but is actually assistance actually increases the likelihood of an accident, because people become blasé or
they pay even less attention, right?
They're paying less attention to the driving as the vehicle takes right. on more and more, and we see that also. This is essentially what Tesla has done in rolling out keeping the car in the lane.
Right.
And so, but my point is that Google's approach, which is all or nothing, is what we call cramming, because they're waiting until it's perfect, near perfect, to launch. But in the meantime, this incremental approach, which they think can never work, but strangely, the history is filled with kludges that have been perfected over time, or inelegant solutions that have become widely accepted, because markets, that's how markets work. We have an inefficient, barely logical system in place that eventually diffuses throughout a user population, and then because of network effects and switching costs and the ecosystem that builds on top of it, it becomes entrenched. And so that is the system you have to weigh the perfect solution against. So the good enough solution tends to win against the perfect solution, even if, and this is the shocking thing, even if the imperfect solution kills people. And we're at that point where, you know, why
software
do we still
will
have,
decide, yes.
Well, you know, people say, well, this will not be as safe as a perfectly autonomous system. Well, what we have is extremely unsafe. We have
a million people die a year in car accidents.
We have organic beings in charge of vehicles who do so while drinking and doing all kinds of stupid things, and we tolerate them. We even tolerate people on motorcycles, which are as I've
organ donor devices.
Yeah, as I've spoken about before. You know, I was on the highway actually just before I was in California. I saw on the highway someone on a moped. At highway speeds, which I think many mopeds can do this, and next to a semi truck, and on these roads we allow this. We allow this vehicles which are enormous, weighing thousands or
hundreds
dozens
of thousands,
tons. To be next to vehicles which would essentially have a tiny engine and no protection
right.
For the driver. So this is the soup we live in, the messy world we live in, and into that it's easier to step into with an incremental improvement to the product that is what the automakers are shipping. So my estimation is that because they're shipping, because they're improving, even if they're not very clever, and you know, I would always just say the Google guys are more clever than the auto guys, but the auto guys are shipping, right? And real artists ship. And so the auto guys are going to keep improving the product, and they have distribution, they have everything else. Now, Google can try to put out a system, but guess what, though? If they don't make the whole widget, that system has to be acceptable. And guess how hard it's going to be for them to bump aside,
right.
You know, the value chain that's established. You know, there are vendors. If you're in Europe and you need a car management or an ECU, you go to Bosch. If you're in the U.S., you may go to, I don't know, it's not Bendix, Delphi,
yeah, right.
Something like that. There are these vendors who automakers turn to. Maybe Bosch at some point says, okay, Google, what you got? Let me see if I can slot it in. But if Google says, yeah, we're here at your service, how would you like our nifty little piece of software? It's one thing, but I think they'll find it very difficult to integrate into the value chain. And I think even though Google wants to resist this, they'll have to make their own cars in order for that this process to become. So here we have to wait for Google to perfect the system. Then they have to perfect the car making system and perfect the marketing system so that they can actually deploy this technology that they dream of.
So will these things happen off road first? You know, we've talked about this as well in the past, where the modular vehicles, the other changes are happening in off road. Let's say 4x4s, things like that. Will we see autonomy in large?
Well,
equipment,
you know, the
kind.
Military is keen on this, and they're also funding the robot development of a company that's owned by Google, which is
Boston, US, right?
Yeah, Boston Robotics or something like that. And they, you know, they make these mules or dogs,
right,
that can carry packs that follow the soldier around, and those certainly have a market because the military needs those kind of products. In fact, the theory, so I'm working on a pretty major piece of work that's going to get published and hopefully soon. And the studies, the reading 100 technology stories, as I have, you get to see the invention and you get to see how the market formed for that invention. And the most iconic technologies were initially purchased, meaning what do I call market zero, the first instance of a purchase of a product that allows that technology to end up in the hands of eventually everybody. But that first instance, sometimes called the earliest, you know, the innovators or the earliest buyer, but in this case, what I call market zero, is usually an institution which is looking to the technology as something that has what I call systemic impact, which means that it affects the whole system. It is not something that plugs in simply. Plugging in and being compatible and conformable with an existing network is what happens during the later phases, the accelerated phases. The very earliest instance, like the first microwave was bought by the U.S. Navy to put on a ship because it was an environment where they didn't want to have fire, where they didn't want to have heat. They wanted to have a way of cooking things and they weren't sensitive to price and they weren't sensitive to size because the first microwave oven was enormous. It was based on radar technology, and the radar the component that generated the microwaves was a very large thing at the time. So the very first instance of a microwave was a military, and many, many other technologies where the government was the first buyer, and they were looking at it again as either a military application or something that had broad and deep implications. And that's why still to this day, the military through DARPA and SBIR and other programs is funding fundamental research, because they would be the first buyers of it. And so this is why, and when I think about it and I ask, okay, so in autonomy, they shouldn't aim at the middle of the market, which is where things go up a ramp. They should be looking at these point solutions. And I think you brought up the right one, which is military /
off-road.
Off-road or fleet sales or things where, you know, what if, here I'll give you another example. Autonomous carts already carry parts inside of factories, and they do so because they have under the floor, they have magnets that identify the routes they need to take. And so these autonomous robotic vehicles are used in factories to move parts around. Now, the next logical place for them would be in a port that's handling containers. So there's this need to offload these intermodal containers. They usually come off of a ship onto a truck, and the truck then takes it to a point where it's put yet again onto either another long-distance truck or onto a railroad, a railway train, or it's staged in the storage area. And these vehicles are today driven by humans, but again, they will become autonomous. Yet another example is that mines, which have these giant, huge trucks that carry ore,
sure,
typically, right? Those vehicles now are becoming autonomous. And so those are logical applications, early applications of autonomous driving, but they're on fixed routes that are well understood and marked, usually with some beacons.
Right. Well, which brings up to me the next question with all this. As you may know, a consortium of German auto companies bought Navtec from Nokia. So is the information layer going to be decisive? The mapping of the physical world. I read recently that Google is actually mapping and imaging Best Western and Motel 6 hotel rooms for anyway, one could imagine the applications, I suppose. But is that going to be decisive? So because Google has a tremendous, you know, GIS infrastructure, Apple obviously is building.
Yeah.
There's more and more, and then we have the car makers, maybe with Navtech, maybe behind. Who knows? You know, is that going to be the key lever when the technology is ready?
Well, so you point out something very important, which is that it's not algorithms and software exactly. It's probably 20% algorithms, 80% data.
Yes.
And the data is going to come from mapping solutions, typically much higher resolution maps than we have today, or street view type views, which are probably, you know, centimeter resolution. Which is how I think the actual Google effort is enabled by providing that level of detail allows them to do a simple compare between what they see and what should be there. And to the extent that it's not what they see doesn't match what's there, it allows them to identify obstacles and other things, which they can analyze in further detail. But the first pass is much more. It's reducing the complexity of the problem by orders of magnitude if you have a lot of storage, and so that's the premise of data in this world. And you're right, that becomes a data problem and the data ownership and collection problem, where that data today is either owned by Google or Apple or
Audi, BMW, and
or the Daimler. Automakers, right? Through what used to be Navtech.
That's really it. I mean, those are the big players right now. There's OpenStreetMap, which has some,
and there's TomTom, which I think TomTom provides a big chunk of Apple's data, but not as much.
They don't have the cash like Google and Apple. Yeah, that's a. I wish them well, but it's going to be tough. Yeah.
But so I wouldn't be surprised if TomTom is acquired. But that's not the end of it, because you still have to spend a lot of money.
Right, maintaining it and
maintaining it and I estimate it's $1 to $2 billion a year per major map service. And if you go to autonomous, you might go up to, you know, well over $2 billion a year.
Absolutely. You can imagine we had a project in Madison, some new bridges and things, and there was just the strangest off ramp that was quite a distance away, and I was thinking about this exact issue with that, because you would have to really be deep in the construction permitting process or the design process to pick up on that at the right day and the right time. And or you'd have enough data from satellite or other things to essentially see what's going on, or the cars are driving constantly.
But also, yeah, you could use a lot of sourcing through crowdsourcing of the data.
That article mentioned the Motel 6 and the Best Western said that Google was using all their Android devices to track some of these things, right? Which makes sense. You've got these devices all over the place, and they're warehousing the location data, obviously. So
sure. But again, I'm careful about suggesting that there's a sort of a killer
vector
asset,
yeah.
Right? That this is the control point. And people love these things. They always say,
secret sauce, we found it.
They've cornered the market.
Right.
You know, in reality, that's very, very rare. And what the response is usually, if there's even a hint of a possibility that can happen, the stakes are high enough that people just react to it in advance and do something about it. And I suspect that the stakes are so high here, as we saw already, the automakers have responded, and they're not fools about it. The U.S. automakers may end up having a problem because but Japan's interesting. Japan, actually, there's laws against there being, the data, I think, needs to be partially, at least, in a JV. Although I've heard opposite points of view on this. I heard it from one industry source that said that Japan does not permit non-Japanese companies from owning GIS data. But on the other hand, Google is out there doing mapping, so it could be that
their own, right?
But it could be also JVs. There are some ways around it. But there's still there are political considerations. There are obviously this privacy and monopoly consideration. So I it's not quite so simple as saying a game over. The game hasn't even started, and I we'll see what happens there. But yeah, so when you put these pieces together and you look at it, the thing that you have to pay attention to is that this is a long road, no pun intended. But this is a long road, and what happens is that at each stage, it changes a little bit the perspective. And so we're seeing right now very early stage and a lot of positioning going on. Automakers, software companies, emerging automakers who are starting in this business, being enabled by technology and particularly electric power, batteries and motors. And so all of this is happening. There are many moving parts. It's not at all easy to predict what's going to happen. My take is that I think it's a 50-50 bet if you think that it sustains or disrupts. I think I'm leaning more towards sustains, that the autonomous technology will be something automakers will be like, heck, why wouldn't I want this? If customers are willing to pay a little bit extra for it, as Cadillac is doing now, as Mercedes is already done, they'll just keep adding more features and try to make that product better.
I completely agree. So let's talk about that the long road, as you say, the euphemism. Recently, I saw a General Motors executive was pontificating about their powerful position in this space, and it made me wonder, given these building blocks, what's required to play. The basis of competition, as we've discussed in this show, is certainly shifting more and more toward software and data, algorithms and data. So is it even possible for the incumbents to play, or are they going to be essentially assemblers for Apple and Google's software, more or less? And I don't know if there's anybody else, but those two.
I think it's... what the theory would say that this is completely asymmetric, that or you could interpret it as being asymmetric. If the business model associated with it is one where there isn't any more car to own, business model, so that's what the logic of Uber might be,
right?
Or that the business model is that you pay for the experience, not for the product, or something has to change where the incentives are such that either whoever's making cars today will say, that's not for me, I'm not going to want to do this. My cost structure or my profit or my margin will just disappear, and so that's where I'm struggling to see. I can see that being in the service model that Uber is promoting. I can see that being a threat. I can see possibly, but even Apple. If I think about Apple as a car maker, I don't see that as a business that I think it'll be hard to replicate what Apple does. But it won't be, Apple may, by the way, I have a new pet theory on Apple, which is that I think that for them,
it's a good show for that horse.
Yeah. So I remember, I don't know if I said this out loud before in this show or at somewhere else, but I was unable to guess whether Apple's going to go at this with a 50,000 unit target or 100,000 unit target or whatever. I've come to the conclusion that if they don't do a million unit target, I don't think they would be in it. Meaning that I think they need to be doing this because they're going to be a major player. To give you an idea of what a million units means, it's number 10 in terms of market size
worldwide, right?
Market share globally,
right.
It would be above Subaru but below Mazda, and it would be somewhere at the bottom of the top 10, right? But there are two Chinese companies now holding slots 9 and 10, so that that's why I put it out as a tweet saying, if Apple wants to be serious, they should target being at least as big as I don't remember the names. I'm embarrassed to say, but these Chinese companies, and so I think a million units would put them in at, don't forget the global market, maybe by the time they launch will be somewhere around 90 million mm-hmm. units a year. So that's by no means a huge tiny market share. Yeah. It's 1-2%. And so it's, to suggest, when they started in the phone business, they went, they gunned for 1% share. And in the first year. Now, so could Apple do a million cars a year? So now we start to discuss the production system, the job to be done, and the timing of everything. So when I think about that, I would say, I can't see them doing a fully autonomous car. I'd see them doing a really smart car. I'd see them doing a car that's designed to be owned, because Apple is not going to be a service provider, I think, initially.
Not in the near term. No, I agree.
That's a different DNA. And I think that the logic is that these are beautiful objects. Typically, if you don't own it, if it's something that you think are cabs beautiful things, never. I've never seen a cab look fantastic. Usually cabs are black cabs.
Boxes, yeah.
Yeah, they're designed to be functional in the eyes of the cab owners. And so, lately it's more Prius, less Crown Vic. In the UK, they're, the London cab, or the design of UK cabs, is very, very iconic, but it's going away to be something, like a minivan. It's never been the pretty thing. So now that's, if it's a Prius is inherently designed around efficiency. So it's not a beautiful thing. So I think Apple's not interested in making things which are not beautiful. I think Apple's going to make beautiful things, and I wouldn't expect it's not just Apple. It's knowing Johnny Ive and Mark Newsom and all those guys there who are
car
designers.
Guys and aesthetic guys, right?
Yeah, and everybody in management there is adorned with beautiful cars.
So 2019 for Apple, maybe. That's what people say.
Maybe. If that's the target, and I, 2019 means the design has already been done.
Right.
As far as the body shape.
Supply chain's happening now.
They've been working on, they probably have, like, I imagine, 3D printed models that fill a warehouse already that have been playing with for that's how design works. They, iterate 1,000 times.
Right.
And they've been thinking about it so long, and now it's a matter of filling in the systems that go inside the body. So I can't imagine anything else. The only question in my mind was, again, the volume. The volume was the biggest puzzle I had to solve. And I just kind of came to this conclusion after eliminating everything else. So they have to be targeting. Now, will they get a million first year, or will it take 5 years? I don't know. That I do not know. But they're not in this to make 50,000 units, which is what Tesla does today. To make a million would be, I think Tesla is looking at 500,000 in like 2020, I think.
Right, right. Well, you would need partners or Foxconns around the world to pull off the million, I assume.
One decent sized plant could do it, but I don't think that's the plant architecture is another question. I think if and I do believe they have on the shelf production systems that, as we talked many times about, iStream and even what BMW is doing with composites, that if they can think of a way to crack this puzzle of production. Here's why this leads into the production question. A million units means either one plant that is working, that's going to cost multiple billions of dollars, that's going to be working three shifts, you get to that number, okay? I think for example, I don't know what the Ford F-150 plant is doing in terms of production, but that's the best-selling car in the U.S. or vehicle in the U.S.
Right.
And that's a plant that's, probably generating at least a million units a year. So what I would be looking at is, but that's assuming it's a sheet metal process. If it's a composite and perhaps different frame design, would they split up the plant into multiple regional plants? Would that make sense? Because then you're saying a million global, but they might be producing some in America, some in China, some in Europe. I would seriously consider that, because firstly, you have local content, local jobs, you have local sourcing. you have potentially local taste. You could deal with customization local. And so why not do it that way? Why not do 300,000 units in three different plants? Each plant, even split that up further to go down to 100,000 units even, potentially, right? All this is possible with new architectures.
Right,
that would not be possible for sheet metal because you got to have these extremely expensive, very large machines that cut and stamp the stuff.
Right. But if we're talking 2019, presumably within the next 12 months, one would think some of that might enter the public domain in terms of where and who would all
Yeah,
that.
You're right. I mean, they have to break ground on the plant, and they'd have to do that within a year or two, and they'd have to also buy a lot of tooling and start pre-production mules and all those other things. So you're right. It's cutting it pretty close. 2019 is pretty tight.
Indeed.
So I don't know. This is a big puzzle. But once we start hearing more, we'll be able to calibrate this whole logic. And don't be afraid, or I should say, don't be disappointed if we see something that looks like it's a 50K run on a year one. 50K run is for, you know, could well be year one, but they're just getting the system working.
Mm-hmm.
I still believe they have to have an ambition level at a million a year, and I would imagine even higher. I would imagine they could easily go to say that their internal goal is 5 million a year at some point in the future.
So just to sort of wrap a little bit on some of these topics, especially the living room in the car, it seems obvious today that the basis of competition in many cars is the software, the electronic experience. I was running into my Volkswagen dealer every now and then for maintenance or what have you, and I always ask, and they talk about the lane.
The lawsuit.
The trial lawyers and all that, right. So anyway, they talk about – I always ask about what buyers are discussing and what they want, and it's the cameras, the lane change notifications, all these things. So if we fast forward 4 years and think about that introduction, that Apple introduction, is it the aesthetics? Is it the experience? Is it the continuity, right? They do that in their current products. What is the contribution that they can pull off in 4 years, of course?
Did the dealer ever mention that people were asking for the clock in the dashboard to self-update when you have daylight savings?
That would be an achievement.
I think that would be earth-shattering. Probably they'll need a few more tens
fewer
of millions
generations,
of lines.
Right.
No, a few tens of millions of lines of code, because I think they're at 100 million now. So, you know, what's another 10 million lines to get that clock working?
But since we're speculating, let's speculate on what that meaningful contribution in 4 years would be. You know, is it aesthetic? Is it experience? Is it continuity, as you say? Is it luxury? Is it gold? Is it, you know, rose gold?
I think there's multiple dimensions. I think electric is a fashion item today. It's not really the strangest thing, of course, that I've ever heard of is that people buy a car based on the price of gas, meaning that this year people are buying SUVs again. Last year they were buying Prius and electric. And that means just it shows how unarithmetic people are, because the logic of essentially what it boils down to is that people's decisions are very much driven by instinct or by spur of the moment, or maybe they're just brainwashed by advertising. I don't know, but there's a lot of this that does not add up. So we can't base our logic of how the trend is going to happen on the basis of any calculation. What I think we need to think about is how will buyers be influenced by whatever comes out, and therefore how will taste be changed by an innovator? So taste is that thing that Apple's very, very good with. And so possibly the iconic, so what the world may come up, I think what Apple would probably come up with is something that will change people's perception of what a good car is. I think it's going to be that kind of giant leap in some ways that Volkswagen had. If you remember, Volkswagen launched in the 60s and 70s in the U.S. when everything was a land barge.
Everything was huge, right?
Everything was huge. And here came a really asymmetric vehicle, not anti-establishment, but it was something about it being
counterculture. Sure, of course,
it was counterculture. That's it. It was countercultural, mm-hmm. and it ended up being the best-selling car in the world over its life, and it just completely changed tastes, and people were drawn to it, and I think it there's that possibility that Apple will buck the trend. So what I see as a trend that's spent and overexposed is this idea of large SUV type vehicles. I think that there are
even sedans. I mean, look at the size of a 5 Series today versus 20 years ago.
Yeah, the enormous. Size of everything has gotten way too big.
Right.
We have cars like the Mini, which isn't that many anymore.
No.
We have cars that are like the Fiat 500, which is nostalgic, although not as small as it should be, nor as fun as it should be. But also we have this smart car from Mercedes,
Daimler.
Which, by the way, is like 15 years old in design.
Yes, it's about.
So you know, we have some interesting experiments there, and I'm tempted to believe that small will be desirable at some point, and then not because of any practical. It's not that the smallness will be seen as economical. Rather, the opposite. Even I learned this lesson in Italy, where the cheapest cars are Fiat, usually Fiat whatever the Fiat smallest Fiat is, and into that market came Smart. This is before the 500. So into that market came Smart, and Smart was actually smaller than the smallest Fiat, right? It was a two seater, and the Smart was sold at a premium to the market, and it was seen as a prestigious product, and so it depends again on and Italians are you as you know very taste driven,
sure,
and so for them to choose this German designed small car that somehow trumped even the small car specialist Fiat. That was interesting.
Well, we see some data on that too with small, let's say, luxury performance cars from Mercedes and not so much BMW, a little bit, but Mercedes certainly has the A-Class and the B-Class, and you know they offer some fairly quick versions of those. So maybe you're onto something there. Maybe that will be
think
the
I would entry not point at all. Apple. I would not be at all surprised if Apple launches a tiny car, and it would be a car that actually people will think, I'll take two. You know, they'll say, yeah, well, the kids could use it, you know, and it won't be the only car you'll own, but it'll be something that people will just think of, and it'll be iconic. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, the most iconic cars have been small.
Yes.
Even American cars, if you think the Ford Mustang in its time was a tiny car, it was a pony car, right?
Right. The Corvair.
The Corvette, it's not
the
as
Corvair,
iconic.
Corvair, I should say.
Oh, Corvair, but that's.
Yeah, well, it had its moments, but yes.
Yeah, but it, if you think back, you know, the Model T was a small car, the Volkswagen's a small car, the 2CV is a small car, the Mini's a small car, the 500's a small car, the Lada is a small car. Every large production vehicle has been small, and even when the Japanese came, it was the Civic that was a small car. Right,
the Accord. They were all small then.
Yeah, well, Accord came up a bit, but it was the very first entry was with a small car, and then the Japanese went in with both. I think what was the Toyota? It was starts with C, right?
The Celica, Corolla,
Corolla. That's
right. The
Corolla was number one selling, and the Civic was number one selling in the U.S. Right, and they were came in with small cars, and so I would not be surprised that, especially since everything is ballooning and getting obese,
yes.
that they come in with small and cute.
Go the other direction, right? Small,
exactly.
And, cute.
And you think about it. Not hey, it's nice, it's cute on the outside, and inside it's unbelievable because it's going to have. you know, like an all glass or right. all, you know, displays, everything.
Continuity, you, of course.
It'll be just amazing inside. And it'll be a little, like a little iPod.
I think that's a good way to wrap it, this show, a little iPod.
The Apple Pod.
The Apple Pod, yeah, a little iPod, a little iPod. Well, it's always great. It's always great, Horace. And we'll catch you again soon. All right.
All right, man. Thanks.